I received a number of emails from last week, and I'll just begin with a couple comments responding to some of those emails. Questions. First, someone asked me, I had mentioned there are schools which, if you don't have, your father doesn't go to COWL, you can't, they don't accept you. So I actually spoke to my friend, I wanted to confirm this, in Lakewood, and he tells me that that is indeed the case. Basically, it's not officially the policy that you have to be in COWL, but they'll give you a hard time, they'll make it difficult for you, similar to what goes on in Israel with the Sephardim, especially the Sephardic girls in the Haredi schools. He told me that because he's in Chinuch, he has an easier time, but he doesn't equal a COWL Jungerman. So it definitely is a real issue there. Now, some other questions I was asked about Mali Adumim and the Sfarim. Let me just show you some of them now. Well, first of all, I saw that they actually do publish a Sefer on Rav Kook, one of Rav Kook's Sfarim, called Orot HaTfilah. But among the Sfarim are here Rabbi Rabinovich's classic Yad Peshuta, which is really the probably the most outstanding commentary on the Mishnah Torah in our day. It's only about a third of the way done. Then you have this book, you recognize it, yellow, Igrot HaRambam, by Rabbi Shalat. It's become now the standard work of the letters of the Rambam, translated from the Arabic. And then there's a number of other books, but one of my favorites is this, the Perish of the Ralbag. They now have about four volumes of it, so that's important. Now, someone else asked me about, I mentioned that Rav Kook gave some heterim that today might be regarded as extreme, but it's really anachronistic. And I was asked to give an example, and I said kidneyote derivatives. I really have to clarify that. He actually was somewhat stringent because he held that the kidneyote derivatives couldn't come in contact with water. That is, you could just take corn syrup and mix it with something, but it couldn't come in contact with water, and that is a stringency, actually. Rav Yitzchak Hanan, Spector, and many others had no problem with any kidneyote derivatives, no matter what you did with it. In fact, Hirsch, Shimshon Raphael Hirsch permitted kidneyote derivatives, although I know that today the Kilas Adas Yishurin once accepted for their Hechsher. Very interesting. And I'll mention something about the Rav conference. About kidneyote derivatives, I will tell you the Sri Deyeshu we'll be talking about next class permitted as well. Rabbi Blau from YU told me that the Rav first permitted it, and then he changed his mind. And that's really interesting because it got the Rav into a lot of trouble. I don't know if this was in the movie. I haven't had a chance to see the movie. He announced
it was
once,
not. It wasn't.
Okay, well, the story is that in the 50s, in one of his shiurim, one of the big public shiurim, he started going on about how Barton's candy, it's not kosher because they have corn syrup, and Barton's at that time was under the OU's hashgacha, and they were furious. He basically declared they're not kosher. They threatened to sue. They were going to sue the Rav. I think the figure was for $50,000, and the Rav was forced to take out an ad. I believe the RCA paid for it in the Jewish newspapers, saying that he was only speaking theoretically and learning, that he didn't mean to say that Barton's, in those days, Barton's was like the only kosher candy for Pesach, not like today. We used to go around and sell it as kids. I don't even know if they're still around. But today, the OU would not give hashgacha to them. But those who are interested in learning more about this topic, here's the standard, the classic book on the subject. You can see it. Issues in Jewish Dietary Laws, Gelatin, Kidney Oat, and Their Derivatives by Rabbi David Sheinkoff. His father is a great Rav. He's also a big Talmud Chacham from Chaim Berlin.
Can I make a quick comment, Mark?
Yeah. Yeah.
I spoke to someone who is pretty well connected in Israel about Rabinowitz being a Gadol HaDor and so on, who's greater him or Avaron, and an interesting comment was made to me that Rav Nachum Rabinowitz could never attain the status of Gadol HaDor because of his extremist religious Zionist views.
Well, I mean, that's a different issue entirely, because Professor Tursky said that the reason the Rav was never regarded as the Gadol HaDor was because of the Zionism, but I'm just talking about in terms of quality. If you examine, and I told you I don't like the phrase Gadol HaDor. It's a political term, but certainly Gadol, because everyone has their, by any measure, I could say Rav Yashiv. Rav Yashiv would have had the same learning today that he had he remained with the chief rabbinate, but he wouldn't have been regarded as the Posek HaDor. he would have been the same person, but he wouldn't have had the same, he wouldn't have been in their camp politically. So Gadol Hadar is not about how much learning you have. It has to do with what camp you set yourself in politically. And as I said, the best example is Rav Elyashiv, who was pasul before, and then when he left the Rabbanut, all of a sudden he's kosher. But that's a side issue. One more thing I will tell you, just interesting. In my town, West Orange, we have an aisle which is under the hashkacha of the local Vod. So all they have there is OU and OK, the Hamish hashkacha, no triangle, okay, anything like that. I went just the other day and I looked very carefully. There's only one product there which is by not one of these Hamish hashkachas, and it's this. Some of you might know it, Joyva Marshmallows. And if you look, who gives the hashkacha? It's Rabbi David Sheinkoff. But Pesach time, they'll take this out. Because why? It has corn syrup, and it's interesting. Right on the package, it says liquefied leguminous extracts. For example, corn syrup is kosher for Passover, and kosher Passover foods are fully sanctioned for Ashkenazim and Sephardim alike by preeminent Orthodox halachic authorities, including the renowned Posek Adar, Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector Zatzal. Right on the package. So that's... in Israel, all the hashkachas will, many of the hashkachas will give it, but not in America. Okay, one more comment. Someone emailed me, this relates to the first class where I spoke about wearing a kippah, that they saw that in the Rav video that was shown in Toronto, in one of the scenes, it didn't look like he was wearing a kippah, and if I thought that that was possible, and I said that certainly if the picture was taken outdoors or if it was taken in a studio, there's no reason to expect that he would have had it, but if in a private house, I would be very surprised if it wasn't wearing a kippah.
I didn't notice anything, really.
Yeah.
I mean, there was nothing in the movie that said, oh, he's not wearing a kippah, you know. But since
it was brought up, let me show you an interesting picture from the Frankfurt Orthodox community, a wedding, pictures taken outdoors. I don't know how well you could see it, but in this picture... all the women are wearing shadels, and none of the men have kippot on. And this is from the Frankfurt Orthodox Separatist Hirschian community. It's a story. It's a biography, a family history of a family, one of the Frankfurt Orthodox families. And it's a very interesting picture. Shadels, but no kippot. Okay, that brings it up to where we are now. Now we'll continue with where we left off with Rav Kook. We ended last class. I quoted a passage from Rav Kook in Arpalei Tohar, in which he said that, quote, at times there is a need, when there is a need to transgress the way of the Torah, and there is no one in the generation who will show the way, the thing comes about through breaching. Nevertheless, it is better for the world that such a matter come about unintentionally. Only when prophecy rests on Israel is it possible to innovate such a matter as a temporary measure. This is done with express permission. With the damning of the light of prophecy, the innovation comes about through a long-lasting breach, which saddens the heart with its externals, but gladdens it with its inner contents. In other words, when continued adherence to a certain halakha will have negative consequences, and there is no formal mechanism to update the halakha, providence ensures that people begin violating it, and in time, this is no longer regarded as a violation. It becomes accepted, even among the halachists. And there's numerous examples of this. Those who look at it from the outside, what Rav Kook calls the externals, are of course saddened by the violation, since it appears to be rebellion against halacha. Yet those who can see what's really happening, who recognize the, quote, inner content, that's Rav Kook's words, realize that matters are being directed by providence, in what is a necessary adjustment to the halachic system. Note that he says that it's better for these matters to come about unintentionally, organically, naturally. We can't have people, obviously, intentionally violating halacha in order to force the rabbi's hand, so everyone violates halacha, and then the rabbis are forced to say, "Imenam Navi," if they're not prophets, they're sons of prophets. It has to be an unconscious, natural development among pious people. Now, today, when I think about how we are so conscious of everything we do and we have a historical sense, I don't know if we can have the sort of unconscious development in halakha that took place for so many years. In fact, Yitz Greenberg has actually told women, and he's quoted this way in the Jewish Week a couple years ago, to create facts on the ground. Ignore what the rabbis say, do what you want to do, create facts on the ground, and the rabbis will later be forced to justify it. And as I said, this has happened many times in our history, as Greenberg is well aware, but I don't know of any examples where it happened in a conscious way, where people consciously are violating halakha. On the contrary, the people who violated halakha or the accepted norm were not conscious that they were being deviant in any way or that they were rebelling against rabbinic authority. Things just sort of developed in a certain way. Now, this passage, as I mentioned, from the book Arpalei Tohar, the conservative movement, I'll talk about the conservative movement in a few minutes. The conservative movement is, of course, conscious. Zachariah Frankel, though, who's really the intellectual brain behind it all, he would not be regarded a conservative today, he believed, of course, that rabbis can't make decisions. Rabbis simply, any changes in halakha come from the people. Kol hamon kekol shaddai, the voice of the people is the voice of God, and the rabbis can then later approve it. So the rabbis don't lead, they follow. There's a mystical sense to his writings almost. Schechter later called it Catholic Israel. And Frankel also said another important point. Frankel asked the question, if we're talking about the people carrying revelation, then what about in the days of the Baal, in the days of the prophets? Most people worship the Baal, so is that correct? And Frankel said you have to be the pious ones. I would say the problem with the conservative movement is you have a whole movement where no one's Shomer Shabbos, no one's Shomer Kasher, so you can't look at them and say that there's a religious sense. You don't have a ritual instinct in the people. Frankel himself pointed that out. So now the movement is making changes. Although, in a sense, I think Rabbi Kelman's right. Everything they're doing is a game almost, because the people have already decided and they're just giving the rubber stamp on it. But it's the people are not the observant population that Frankel and Schechter believed. Yeah, I agree with you. They do what the people want. The difference is with Frankel, it wasn't what the people wanted. It was what the people naturally did. And today, everyone is conscious that we're breaking with halakha for whatever reason. So it's very different.
The example with Bris Milah, Mitzvah Bepeh, could be a good example where it's abhorrent to a lot of from people, no matter what the halakha says.
That would be an example. It's not even halakha. It's a minhag, basically, which has a standing. But that would be an example of where, if the people as a whole stop doing it, but I don't think the people would think they're violating halakha. They're convinced that this is not the halakha. Because how can the halakha require you to do something which is dangerous? So that's what I would think. But even if they did, there would be an example of where pious people, if they all got together and refused to do Matzitza Bepeh. But they don't need to do that. I mean, there's so many who didn't do it. Of course, you have Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, you have Rav Chaim Zedek, you have many poskim in Lithuania. I call your attention to the article in the journal Hakira by Shlomo Sprecher, who, and I have a letter to the editor. He missed some sources. Rav Herzog wrote about that you don't need to do it. Rav Cook says you don't need to do it. In Lithuania, it was not regarded as such a big deal. It's become a big deal.
Actually, the point I was trying to make is that's one of the only examples I can think of where, assuming you thought that was the halacha, it's abhorrent to many people. Can't think of any other example where, it just on the face of it, it seems so abhorrent.
Okay, that's a good question. I have to think about other examples. I don't know whether they believe it's a halacha. I don't think it's an example of where it's a halacha and people are saying, but it's abhorrent, so we reject it. They don't think it's a halacha, and they think it's abhorrent because it's precisely because it's not halacha. And now, if you look in the Gemara, it's clear. It's just for a medical reason. It's not halakha. So I don't know if that's an example of from Jews saying it's abhorrent and it's a halakha, it's abhorrent, and we're rejecting it. And Rav Cook would not say you can do that. It has to be the ethical sense, unconscious. Now, this passage appeared in this book, Arpalei Tohar, and as I mentioned last class, this is censored. Not only is it censored, it's an act of forgery because they took out words, and they didn't just take out words, they substituted other words for it. What happened was, though, that this work, a few copies of this had been printed around 1916, 1917. Scholars had it. They immediately called attention to it. It became a big cause celeb in Israel. The Settlers' Journal, Nakuda, had a big article. Who's afraid of Rav Cook's writings? I think it was. Ma'ariv picked it up. And about 5 years ago, this volume was published. Two of them, Shimona Kfatzim, the 8 notebooks of Rav Cook, including Arpalei Tohar. How this was published is another long story, which I won't get into, because there was a split among the followers of Rav Cook. After all, the they, the followers of Rav Kook refused to publish this for many years. When Rav Avram Shapiro became chief, became head of Merkaz Harav Yeshiva, he was put in charge, and he gave permission to publish it, and there's big feuding between Rav Avram Shapiro and, I guess you'd say, more fundamentalist followers of Rav Kook or Tzvi Yehuda, and they broke away from Merkaz. Merkaz broke in, too. But the book has appeared now. There is no more censorship. You can read what Rav Kook wrote, not just here, in many other places as well. Now, what I mentioned last time was that Rabbi Shalat, the editor of the Rambam's Letters, a renowned scholar, a careful scholar, one of the most careful scholars, he was the editor of Apoy Tohar. And how could he have been involved with this forgery? I always wanted to ask him this question. I don't know him. I have a few letters from him. I always said, one day I'll go to Israel, you can ask this question in person, because if I'd send a letter, he probably would ignore it. But someone told me that he was asked, and he only replied that he had nothing to do with it, which means that when he handed the book in for publication, it was one thing, and when it appeared, it was something else. And look, it happened to me once, too, where something I handed in was one thing, and then they removed it for politically correct reasons. So we have examples of that as well. I want to move on now to the fifth and the final of what I regard as the bedrock principles of Rav Kook. That is unity of the Jewish people. Sinners are a part of the Jewish people as well. One must look kindly upon them. When they sin, they don't know any better. They're in the category of ones. They're forced, or tinuk shenishba. They're like babes taken from when they're young. They just say, what do you mean? How could they be? These people grew up in his day. The people who were coming on Aliyah, the non-religious, they basically all grew up religious. Many of them grew up Hasidic. How can Rav Kook call them people who don't know any better? Ones is the word he uses, you know, forced. Just we all know the principle of ones. If you're forced to do something, it's not your responsibility. You're not held responsible. How could you say these people are forced? But Rav Kook develops the notion that in the contemporary world, dominant trends brainwash them. And they really have no free will in their rebellion. They've been brainwashed by communism, by socialism, by secular Zionism. They're not making choices from free will. They're young people in their teenage years, their early 20s, and they get caught up in these ideas. He goes, that's how far he goes to show that they are really not conscious sinners.
Isn't that the same as Afa Pi Shechata Yisrael Hi?
Yisrael who? No, because Afa Pi Shechata Yisrael Hi was simply saying that they're still a part of the Jewish people. Their marriages are still marriages. We still ask to pray with them, but most people would regard them as wicked people. But they're still Jewish, and they're still obligated in all the halachot. Where Rav Kook is going to build up to now is that these people have to be judged positively, even more than positively, although they are lacking in certain parts. They are filling in what the old-time religious are lacking, so you have one synthesis. And let me explain what I mean by that. The non-religious that he's referring to, and he wasn't saying this about the non-religious of Western Europe or the Bundists in Vilna, the assimilationists. He's talking about those people who come to the land of Israel, sacrifice themselves for the land of Israel. They are doing God's work without realizing it. The fact that the non-religious are sacrificing themselves, in some cases their lives, either by marauding Arabs or diseases and clearing the malaria fields, the fact that they are sacrificing themselves to build up the land of Israel shows that they have Jewish hearts. Even if they regard themselves as an act of rebellion against the Jewish tradition, they do not realize that they are part of the great providential guidance going on, and that the time will come, he thought it would be relatively soon, when they too will realize the errors of their ways and return to tradition, because it's no different in his mind if some non-religious Jews wanted to observe Shabbos and Kashrus and said that they're just doing it for ethnic reasons. That's just one step away from recognizing the real reasons for doing it. They are the ones coming and building up the land. It's not an accident that this is Providence is having them do this. Therefore, we cannot judge them like we judge the Bundists or the Zionists, not the Zionists, the assimilationists of Western Europe. Now, everyone in Rav Kook's day was driving the non-religious away. They said you couldn't have anything to do with them. They said the land would split them out. Rav Kook was bringing them close, and this brought about great attacks on him. Well, Rav Nachman of Bratslav, 80 years before that spoke, more than 80 years, almost 100 years before that, spoke of those who will attack tzaddikim, who try to bring the generation closer, try to bring the sinners closer. And that was the perfect example. Now, this connection of Cook to the non-religious tied in with his opposition, his great opposition to Auschwitz, Rav Hirsch's view of Auschwitz. I've already mentioned the Netziv's negative view of it. Rav Cook's teacher, the Netziv, said that to believe in the idea of Auschwitz, of separatism, to separate the Jewish community from the non-religious, is sharper than daggers in your body. According to Rav Cook, by the way, the Netziv explains that internally, we fight. We fight over Shabbos, over Kashrus, but when we have to deal with the outside world, we deal with one people. We go to the outside world, one people, and we all are one people. It's a fight in the family. Rav Cook said that matters are much worse in the land of Israel. To split the Jewish people in the land of Israel is even worse because we must be united. Supposedly, he compared it to Avodah Zarah, idolatry, this notion of separatism. I'm not saying supposedly, he did. I just can't find, I looked for the source, I couldn't find it. On his deathbed, he warned against religious separatism. Now, this was a real issue, because the Eda Haredit, the separatist Orthodox in Israel in those days, were very powerful, because the Aguda was associated with the separatist Orthodox, the Eda Haredit. They gave them money, they had all these connections with them. Later on, they had to split, because the Aguda wanted to be in the government. But at this time, the separatist ideology was very strong, and they were pushing for that. And Rav Cook wrote very strongly, spoke very strongly against it. The notion was elaborated upon by his son, Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook. Here's his picture, who spoke very strongly against Auschwitz. If I had time, I would go into some of the very harsh things he said about the Gedolim, the Aguda Gedolim, who supported separatism. He quoted a Talmudic passage, just to give you one example, that speaks of tzaddikim, who are enam ma'aminim, who don't have faith. And that he said very strong things, because in his day also, you had people arguing, although you didn't have separatisms like in the day of Rav Cook, you didn't have people saying that you should have nothing to do with, technically, with from the citizenship standpoint, with the state of Israel, but you have plenty of people, and you still do, who said, we should have nothing to do with the state in any practical way. We'll just take money from the government, but we're not going to be in the army, we're not going to have any involvement with the non-religious, we're going to create our own ghettos, and that was basically Auschwitz, as much as you can get it in the land of Israel. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda spoke very strongly against it.
Wouldn't everyone agree, even the Aguda, that the act of the non-frum building up the land is still a very large mitzvah?
No, because the non-religious are contaminate the land, and they should not come to the land. And Rav Cook was strongly attacked by the Gerer Rebbe and others for arguing for support of the Keren HaKayemet to buy land.
No, but
for the typical religious people, the non-religious should not be in the land of Israel.
I understand.
Them building up the land is bringing a bad thing to the land of Israel.
I understand, but halachically, there's still the Maisa Mitzvah of Binyan Haaretz. You can't.
No, there's no Maisa
Mitzvah.
No, there's no Maisa Mitzvah. If you observe Shabbos, not because you're observing Shabbos, but because you want a day off and you want to celebrate idolatry on the Sabbath, and the way you celebrate idolatry is through not working, that's not observing Shabbos. They were coming to build an atheist, secular land, and therefore it was a terrible thing that they were doing. It would have been a lot better had they not come. The land is better with no Jews in it than with Jews coming in, and they quoted the prophets that the land will spit you out. So it was a terrible thing, they thought, that the non-religious were coming. He had meaningful relationships with many Haredi Gedolim. Understand, they weren't called Haredim in those days. I mentioned last class, the Lithuanian world was on his side in this dispute. And the Polish Hasidim were on his side in the dispute with the Eda Haredit. That doesn't mean that they agreed with his ideology. The Gerer Rebbe had a famous visit he made to Rav Cook to try to make peace, and he writes how Rav Cook is such a great sage that he can't see bad in anyone. So they did not agree with his philosophical views, but when push came to shove, they were more on his side. Many of them, certainly Rav Tzvi Feisal Frank, Rav Tukachinsky, Rav Zalman Meltzer, and many others. Whether today they would be is questionable, because it's not just that the world has become more extreme, as some people say. It's more complicated than that. His philosophical writings have become publicized now to a greater extent, and they are more problematic for the Haredi worldview. I'll read you some passages if we have time today. You'll see what I mean. Rav Cook compared, contrary to what I just said, the Haredi position, Rav Kook compared the non-religious Chalutzim to the building of the temple. When the temple was being built, anyone could go into it. They can go into the Holy of Holies to build it. But once the temple is built, the high priest goes in once a year on Yom Kippur. The parallel is to the land of Israel. Although the people building up the land are not religious, this is no different than building the temple. Everyone can have a part in building up the land. And it's only a matter of time before the non-religious see the errors of their ways. So they are, and if you're going to say, well, what about the notion that they're bringing atheism to the land of Israel? We spoke last class about how, according to Rav Kook, this atheism is only temporary. It's about this dialectic that the non-religious, the atheism, and the old-time Orthodox Jews, the new ideology will arise from both of them. The atheists will get Torah, the old-time Orthodox Jews will get this physical connection to the land, and you'll have a new Jew. But this was a great departure from the old-line Orthodox, who were horrified, as I said, by this influx of the non-Orthodox. They wanted to keep them out. They lashed out against Rav Kook. Now, Rav Kook is, of course, a very complicated person. There are texts in which he doesn't have such a positive view of the non-religious. There's one famous text he gave a hesped, a eulogy, for a non-religious chalutz who was killed, and he raises the problem there. Like, on the one hand, we appreciate what they're doing, but they're in opposition to everything we regard as holy. So he understood there was ambiguities, but and we said, I mean, he also said that the heresy serves as a stimulant to intellectual ferment. But so you have this. All I could say is that the way I've described it here, you do have occasional divergences, but the general trend of his thought is certainly as I have described it, and this was carried on by his son. When I was in Israel, I used to go to Merkaz Harav Yeshiva sometimes to daven. I remember we used to go for lunch on Shabbos after davening once. Entire Israeli army brigade was there. You know, they would bring them in. None of these people even knew what Shabbos was. But in their mind, and it's not like the Or Sameach approach, which I'll speak about in a few minutes. It's a very different approach. They accept them for who they are, recognizing that they are doing valuable work and defending the land, etc. And they too will come back to Judaism one day. Now, with regard to the non-religious, Rav Kook does not believe that coercive belief is a good idea. This is not how you reach the non-religious today. You don't force people to be religious. You don't force people not to drive on... Well, I shouldn't say not to drive on Shabbos, because that's in the public sphere. But he doesn't want coercive belief. He writes about how, in the previous stage, you had a primitive stage of development, intellectually, and there was a reason, therefore, for restricting freedom of thought. Rabbis put bans on books and things of that nature, but not so anymore. Because even heresy has a positive aspect to it. It can force you to refine your beliefs. Sometimes Rav Kook admits that there should be limits placed on inquiry, but he's not clear as to the particulars. And interestingly, he does say that not everything that's true needs to be stated in every crowd. Even if you know it's true, if you think it's going to negatively affect someone's faith, you don't need to say it. You don't go into Mea Shearim and start talking about evolution. You don't get up in a sermon and start talking about advanced philosophical problems which you know are true or believe are true, because not everyone is capable of understanding that. So Rav Kook, in that sense, is an esoteric, has an esoteric, he's an esotericist, in that not everything needs to be given to everyone. It's almost Maimonidean in that there's a room for the masses to have simple ideas, and the intellectuals are indoctrinated into more enlightened ideas, a very Kabbalistic idea as well.
How would he view El Al not flying on Shabbos? Would that be coercion of the majority?
It's hard to say. What I can tell you is that Ritzi Yehuda Kook during Yamit, Ritzi Yehuda Kook, following his father's footsteps, withdrawal from any part of the land was a terrible sin. So what about Yamit? He was still alive during Yamit, and there were great protests going on, just like in Gush Katif. But in those days, unlike perhaps in Gush Katif, the country was clearly behind Menachem Begin. And his students went down there to Yamit to protest, saying, it's the land of Israel, you must protest. And he said to them, yes, it's a sin, but the people, we can't stand against the people. The people have decided, and that even though they're sinning, they are the Jewish people. So what I can't, I don't, this has nothing to do with El Al, but Ritzi Yehuda, following his father's footsteps, recognized that we don't stand up against the people, just like we don't stand up and go marching against them because they're violating Shabbat. That's not the way to reach them. we don't boycott them, we don't protest them. Sometimes we accept that they're the majority, and we are one family, and we can't fight against them. That's not the way to bring them closer. That, I think, is relevant. Together with this notion of limits on freedom of inquiry for some people, he writes that there is a danger, however, for advanced people, that instead everyone's supposed to have yirat chet, fear of sinning. Rav Kook is afraid that some people, however, are going to start to fear thought itself, which will lead to ignorance. So he's very worried about that. He's not one to run away from conflict, but to deal with it. He's explicit, quote, "One must strive for complete human integration between Torah and wisdom. Torah umada." He's a very strong believer in combining Torah and the best of the modern world, the best of philosophy. Taking what is good and jettisoning the rest. Now, he's such a complicated person. There's a tension between the universalism and nationalism. On the one hand, he speaks very universalistically in many times. He also speaks very nationalistically. He focuses on Jewish sources and then other times on the wisdom of the world. It's because of this that you have Oz V'Shalom on the left, you have Gush Emunim on the right, all find sustenance in him. However you read him, he is, though, a truly creative vision for orthodoxy in modern times, who confronts the world rather than running from it. Now, his first major work, O Rote, most of his major ideas are found in there. If we have time at the end, I don't know if we will, because I want to speak about his relevance still. I could read you some passages, and you really can see the power of his writings from these passages. But first, now that I've sketched the major views of Rav Kook, we must consider his relevance and ask, does he indeed still have relevance, or is he like so many other thinkers of the past whose views were significant in their day? Yeah.
It's interesting, if I may, there was a comment on the conference on Sunday. I forget if it was, you know, who made the comment, but that apparently now in Israel, the thought of the Rav there's a lot more interest in the thought of the Rav, and perhaps a little less in Rav Kook, and the reason they said was because Rav Kook always talks how history is moving, you know, forward towards a messianic ideal. And the Rav, of course, the dialectic, the back and forth, and the zigzagging of history, and they felt with the, quote-unquote, all the setbacks for the religious Zionist movement, Rav Kook is becoming less relevant, and the Rav with the struggle and the suffering is becoming more dominant. That was just one of the speakers made on Sunday.
In the latest tradition, there's an article in there, I forget whose article, not Rav Amichai, someone else, where they make that exact point. And I'll talk in a few minutes, that's perhaps one of the areas where Rav Kook is not relevant, and we'll talk in a minute how Rav Soloveitchik's brand of Zionism, which was the dominant brand of Zionism in America, in Israel, until the 67 war, was usurped by Rav Kook's vision of, as you, Rabbi Kelman, correctly states, messianic, going straight in the direction of Geula. And now with the setbacks, oh, we'll talk about it in just a few minutes. I was actually machaving to what you were going to say. That's the point. What about the relevance of Rav Kook? What does he have to say for moderns? And as I said, we have thinkers who times have really passed them by. And I think that with Rav Kook, as with many great thinkers, we have to speak of both enduring elements of his thought as well as transitory elements. And there is so much that is enduring. The idea that the Jewish people are a unity, that we must love all Jews, that halacha must be responsive to modern civilization, that there is more to being a religious Jew than simply studying Torah. Indeed, in modern times, you cannot just study Torah to be a religious Jew. Being a religious Jew means encompassing all aspects of life. I think these are all relevant, and most of what he says is still very significant. In fact, I believe that Rav Kook provided the basis for Kiruv long before Lubavitch got into it. For in his day, when no one else was speaking this way, he spoke of the preciousness of every Jew, whatever their level of observance. He did this in an era when Orthodox leaders were preaching a very different message about the non-religious. Now, granted, Rav Kook was speaking about the Jews in Israel, but he was saying these things. In Rav Kook's day, if you came to the Kotel, let's say, in short pants, you know, they would throw chairs at you. I mean, they wouldn't invite you for a Shabbos meal. It was a very different... Even into the 1960s, you had Haredi articles and contrasting against bringing Kirov and the non-religious. Rav Kook, as I said, his focus was the Jews in the land of Israel. since through their actions they show that they are good Jewish hearts, even if they didn't follow the rituals, Lubavitch and later Esha Torah and Or Sameach are much broader in their outreach, but he was the first. I wonder, though, about the Haredi groups. Certainly Lubavitch values every Jew, qua Jew. And Rav Kook spoke about how valuable the non-religious Jews were, even if they were not doing anything ritually. I wonder, though, if the Haredi Kiruv groups feel this way. True, they are trying to make Baalei Tshuva. And when they do, they feel that it's a great success, I mean, that's their goals. But do they value the Jew as a Jew or only as a Kiruv project? How do they feel about the Jew who's not part of their project, who has no interest in becoming religious? Do they regard this Jew as precious? Do they feel it's success if a woman, totally non-observant, intermarried, decides to light Shabbat candles and do nothing else? I mean, Chabad sees this as very significant. They see this as very valuable. I wonder if in the Haredi Kiruv groups, my sense at least is that to them is not important. They're not interested, as Lubavitch is, in just do one mitzvah. Any mitzvah is valuable. I can tell you that there are many Haredim, especially in Israel, who don't have a feeling of connection to the non-religious. So I'm not speaking about the Kiruv groups. I'm speaking about Haredi leaders who've written terrible things about the non-religious, so that they're no longer part of the Jewish people. A very different view of the non-religious. If you become modern Orthodox, then you're one step away, I guess, from becoming a Haredi. But I don't know. I mean, they value. I wouldn't go that far. But I'm saying I don't know if they feel there's any significance in just a woman who's non-religious doing one mitzvah, you know, if she doesn't buy, that Lubavitch does. They have a different view. And Rav Kook also had a different view. Now, I could go on. Well, one more thing, I guess I should say, about the non-religious. It's not just the non-religious that Rav Kook spoke this way. He also writes about applying the Ahavta L'Recha Kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself, with regard to the non-Jews. And he decides the halacha in accordance with Meiri, that is, that all the negative things said about non-Jews in the Talmud are only stated with regard to the wicked pagans of old, those who would often sacrifice their children to Molech, things of who are wicked. This deciding like the Meiri is a boundary marker between the Haredim and the modern Orthodox. By definition, a modern Orthodox Jew will adopt the Meiri's position. That means you can't cheat in business, you have to relate to the non-Jew the same way you relate to Jew in monetary matters and everything else, even when it comes to Shabbos. That's the modern Orthodox approach, and in fact, the David Berger in the last Orthodox Forum explains in detail why the Meiri is so significant. The Haredim do not adopt the Meiri, so Rav Kook is very significant in that regard as well.
Mark, wouldn't the whole term modern Orthodox not really come into play in Rav Kook's time? He didn't really adopt that term, did he?
No, we're talking about, I'll get to Hillel's question in a minute, we're obviously talking about precursors, architects. Rav Kook provides, we saw Hirsch with the notion of being involved in the state, term Derech Eretz, secular studies, that provides bases. Rav Kook is with the Zionism and other things, we'll see, Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, Jewish law, none of these people were themselves modern Orthodox. Rav Kook, he wore the strimal, he was, as I said, an ascetic, I mean, but he had certain ideologies of him, which, when modern Orthodoxy became a movement, ideas of him were thought to be appealing. You should know that many followers of Rav Kook are very far from the Chardal elements. Rav Avinair are very far from many ideas of modern Orthodox, but very close to other ideas. So we're talking about precursors. They didn't have a movement of modern Orthodoxy. Now, Hillel asks, Rav Kook was loved by the non-religious. Did he influence them in any way? It's hard to say if he influenced them. He had his famous tshuva mission with Rav Harlap and Rav Zonenfeld also to the various kibbutzim. I can't say that he influenced them to be more observant. I did influence them is that to understand that not all Orthodox Jews were old-fashioned, not all Orthodox Jews hated them, that there was someone they could go to even if they weren't religious. Did that bring people back to religion? Ritzi Yehuda speaks about people, Baalei Tshuva, and Ritzi Yehuda, just like Lubavitch, he tells stories about Chernikovsky, that they got an insight from Rav Kook and it moved them, and he says, that's also a Baal Tshuva, you know, in a small sense, you know, there's different levels of Baal Tshuva. So in that sense, but if you're talking about actually making people religious, having strong influence on them, no, he did not it was the era, a figure even as great as Rav Kook. And let's not forget, he's much greater today than in his lifetime. In his lifetime, he was not the figure he is today. Rabbi Kelman asks, all would agree to ask some of the contestants not to a vote as czar. Yeah, about... We don't... From Erie, there's 2 points to his position. One is that Christianity is not idolatry, and therefore... And they are nations that are bound by laws, and therefore we have to treat them in a certain way. You'll have Poskim who will say, well, it is idolatry... Well, it is idolatry for Jews, not for Gentiles, or even if it is, they still are nations that are bound by certain laws, and therefore we relate to them as civilized people. The Meiri, the theological element wasn't important to Meiri. In pre-modern times, the assumption was idolatry, immoral. The Meiri breaks the connection, really, because now you can have, the importance is not the theology. Idolatry for the Meiri is not a theological concept, it's a moral concept. So if you are technically an idolater, but you are a moral person, then you're not an idolater. You might be worship two gods, but you are not what the Talmud refers to when they talk about the wicked idolaters. Yes, Rav Kook did try to bring people to religion. He went on his march to the various kibbutzim. He wanted to form an organization which would try to bring Judaism to everyone. But what can you do? He didn't have NCSY, didn't have things in those days. He was trying to create a form of Judaism that would enable, he thought, as we'll see, and this is the naivete, the non-religious on their own would see what was happening and come back. We'll get to that in just a couple minutes. Now, there were scholars, I could go on, actually, but I want to skip because I see the time. The Rav distinguished between idolatry and paganism. The latter is behavior. Well, that's exactly what the Inuit is concerned with. Paganism in the sense of wickedness, that is, lack of morality, all sorts of terrible things. That's what the Meiri means when he says nations not bound by civilization. There's no laws that, there could be laws, but they don't govern the outsiders, they only govern yourself. That was the Meiri's point, and this was adopted by all the German Orthodox and became standard position. And that's what the Rav is referring to. I don't know if the Rav ever spoke about the Meiri's position, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. I heard it from Rav Aaron Soloveitchik myself. He was a strong supporter of the Meiri's position, and Rav Kook is, and that's the standard modern Orthodox position. If you look, as I said, in David Berger's article, he'll bring down all the sources from Rav Kook and Rav Chaim David Halevi, Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, all the people you would have expect arguing for the Meiri. Because otherwise, basically, you can't be part of modern civilization. You can't treat other people as equals. It's a fundamentally immoral position for most people. Now, I could go on, as I said, about what is relevant, and there's a great deal to say. Many people, by the way, know Rav Kook wrote some interesting things about evolution. This relates to what Roy Kelman said, so let me briefly mention it. During his time, the theory of evolution was wreaking havoc on religious life. It was the era of the Scopes trial of 1925, and many religious people, both Jews and Christians, were saying that religion is opposed to what science is teaching. Rav Kook realized this was a dangerous thing, to ever say that religion is opposed to science. What do you do when science becomes proven correct? There were scholars, Jewish scholars, who in the 16th and 17th centuries were opposed to Copernicus. What are you supposed to do when Copernicus is proven right? Do you throw out religion? Rav Aryeh Kaplan writes about how when he was a young man in yeshiva, a prominent rabbi declared that according to Torah teachings, there was no way that humans would ever be able to walk on the moon, because we say it in Kiddush Levana every month, just as I dance toward you but cannot touch you, so may none of my enemies be able to touch me for evil. So we say that we cannot touch you, the moon. Now obviously this rabbi was shown to be wrong, and the verse in Kiddush Levana is not referring to travel by rockets. But the point Rav Aryeh Kaplan was making is that science has to agree with Torah, by definition. True science. But Rav Kook's concern, his major concern when it comes to evolution, is not with the literal biblical text. Some said even afterwards, you mean he went to the moon? Yeah.
Yeah, it was a hoax.
By the way, those interested in this, Rav Menachem Kosher has a whole book, Ha'adam HaYareach, Man on the Moon. You can get it online now, HebrewBooks.org, 11,000 Hebrew books online, in which he talks about why this is so important religiously, reaching the moon, what this says. And I think in that article, that book as well, it's a short book, maybe 100 pages, he speaks about ideas of extraterrestrial life. At around this exact same time, Norman Lamb wrote his famous article about the Jewish views of extraterrestrial life. McCook's major concern is not the literal biblical truth, that is, in the 6 days God created the world, since he points out that the creation story has always been regarded as a great secret, and if everything is taken literally, then what's the secret? The real challenge to Judaism from evolution comes from the evolutionary concept that as time goes on, as time passes, we become more refined. The world becomes more refined. The technical term is meliorism. And this seems to contradict the Jewish view, that as the years pass, the generations decline. If they were like men, we're like donkeys. And if they're angels, we're men. And if they were men, we're donkeys. Most Jews think, traditional Jews, that the generations get worse. So how is it that Rav Kook speaks about the generations getting better? And he spoke about, it's a Kabbalistic idea as well, and you can distinguish between Torah knowledge and ethical sensitivity. Well, Rav Kook said, and he was well aware, certain spiritual truths only become revealed with the passing of time. For example, the Pharisees were once a minority party, and yet now we're all descendants of the Pharisees. In earlier times, many people, in certain places, most people thought God had a body, something we now know is ridiculous. It's been abandoned. So over time, truths become available. There is no question that today there is a greater sensitivity to issues of human rights than earlier generations had. For example, the notion of slavery did not trouble earlier generations of Jews, as it does us. So what can I say? The Chasam Sofer, he's much greater than us, but he was not troubled by it. And George Washington wasn't troubled, unlike Thomas Jefferson. I don't think George Washington. You have great people who's Aristotle writes how some people are born into slavery. It's not that these are evil people. It'll be anachronistic to judge them. It's just that was their understanding. But now, from our understanding, we can see how it would be immoral to have those positions. And Rav Kook would see this as an example of ethical sensitivity being refined over time. Rabbi Henkin writes how the fact that the death penalty was made impossible by the destruction of the temple, when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, we can no longer institute a death penalty. That is a step in the direction to the Messianic era, since in Messianic days, there will be no need for this punishment. The very impulse to spill blood, Rav Henkin says, which is part of capital punishment, is something that God is trying to remove from us. Capital punishment was a time-bound notion, which we have spiritually moved beyond. It's still in the sources, we study it, but Rav Henkin's view is that we've moved beyond it. It's something that we study to get schar for studying, reward, but it's not something that's practical, because Rav Henkin was a believer in the notion that Jewish law is a ceiling, is a floor, not a ceiling. That is, you move up from Jewish law. There will become a time, thank God, when we won't have murders, we won't need a death penalty. It reflects an earlier era when we needed something like that. And this is in line with the Kabbalistic view that as humanity progresses, more and more holy sparks are released from the evil side, and this goes on until the Messianic era. Someone was asking.
Yeah, on a side here, someone told me that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein apparently said that he would save a goy on Shabbos if he was drowning, even though the halacha is not allowed to, because he felt that halacha was unethical, and then he would do tshuva.
Nah, it's hard to believe he said that, because first of all, the halacha is you have to save them. The halacha has been you have to save them, even for the Haredi postgame.
No, in theory,
if you're on an island and no one's there, you might have it, so I do not believe that he would have said that. Rav Amital, you know, yeah, Rav Amital has a great dispute.
If not because of Ava, if there's no Mishum Ava aspect, like you said, no one was around or so on, he just thought that halacha on its face was unethical.
Okay, well, look, it's possible, but once it's already, as David Berger pointed out once, I heard him at a conference, Jewish law has to operate according to systems. Jewish law doesn't have notions of ethical sensitivity trumping the halacha. I spoke last class how, well, we basically got rid of capital punishment, and the rabbis tell us that, you know, what they did. They investigated the witnesses all so much. How could they do that? Because they had an ethical sensitivity. Mishum Eva is just one of the tactics we use to try to get somewhere, and so that doesn't mean that if there's no Eva, by definition there's Eva. That's, you can't get rid of that. Eva, for those who don't know, means enmity. Not to mention you have the Meiri and you have other positions. Rav Amital, though, has a big dispute with Rav Lichtenstein. Here's the dispute. Rav Amital has stated, he's the other Rosh Hashiva of Har Etzion. Let's say your plane crashes and you need food. You're going to starve to death. And there's two things in front of you. One is pork, and one is a dead human. According to technical halacha, you should eat the human, right? Because it's perhaps even just a rabbinic prohibition, cannibalism. Whereas eating a pig, it's a biblical violation. Rav Amital said absolutely not. He said he would eat the pig. Because although technically you might say that there's a technical aspect of the rabbinic prohibition of eating a human flesh, this violates ethical sensitivities, which are so basic to Tzelem Elohim, you know, the image of God, that this underpins all of Judaism. So it's not just that you're violating a small rabbinic thing that's ethical, you're violating a whole ethical thing. Rav Lichtenstein was very upset by that, because that's not really a typical halachic approach. But Rav Amital was also very Hasidic, and he said that, you violate the biblical law in the name of the larger...
According to that, Avram Avinu would have said no to the Akedah.
Maybe he should have said no to the Akedah. Maybe that would have been the real test. We don't have time to get into different views of the Akedah. You know, maybe that was what he should have replied. We don't have time to get into the Akedah now. But it's a good question. So what does Rav Cook do then? He applies this progressive view to man's moral life. The highest stage is when people freely choose the good. Because it is good, not because the Torah says to. Rav Cook believed that this was happening in his day. He looked around and he saw that society was more ethical and less violent. So what the Torah commands in this area is no longer viewed as an unpleasant duty. I don't not steal or do something violent because the Torah says, I would do it on my own. This is something people want to do, and this, he says, will become more even as time goes on. So humanity has evolved to a higher level of ethical and spiritual consciousness, and this parallels the physical evolution that created humanity. He says that in the future, the Torah will not need to thwart human desires. People will themselves behave ethically. And he notes how the liberals in his era were fighting for the sparks of good in people's will so that they not be enslaved by the past. And the conservatives, however, look towards the past. And that's what the big thing about conservatism, Edmund Burke and the rest, because they were afraid that the contemporary world would be turned upside down if people's will was given free rein. And Rav Cook says, the job of great souls is to find the middle ground, the middle path. He writes, quote, the theory of evolution shows that the world has a core of good which is constantly reaching new heights. Human nature and its desires were in the past brutish and coarser than they are now, and in the future they will be even more refined. The theory of evolution, now busy conquering the world, is more in accord with life's mystery, as understood by the Kabbalah, than any other philosophical theory. The notion that there is an evolutionary path upwards provides the world with a basis for optimism. For how can one despair when one sees that everything is evolving to ever greater heights? When one penetrates deeply to the principle of evolution in an upward direction, one discovers that it illuminates with the greatest clarity the idea of God. Now, he wrote these words at the beginning of the 20th century. I don't know if this great optimism, meliorism, would have been there had he lived through the Holocaust and the other genocides of the 20th century. But even with this, I think it's impossible to deny that we are more sensitive to issues of human rights than previous generations. The fact that human rights abuses trouble us so much in ways that they did not in previous generations shows that Rav Cook is correct, that there has been a refinement in man's ethical sense. In fact, Rabbi Kelman only mentioned it because Rabbi Kelman, when you say this is not the current theory of evolution, what are you talking about, Stephen Gould, you're talking about punctuated evolution, things of that nature, evolution still believes that things, as time goes on, things become more advanced. And granted, they're talking about random evolution, but Rav Cook isn't concerned about the science, per se. He's concerned about the result. You move from less... Please explain. Speak. It's easier. Can you speak, Carol?
Hit the transmit button.
Hit the transmit button. Hold the transmit button down while you speak. He can't speak. Well, you'll have to explain in what way you think the current theory of evolution... Oh, no mic. No mic in the microphone. Well, if you can hear us, you probably have.
You know what? That's a good plug for people to get mics and webcams. Okay. That's our next goal.
I don't know if you want to write. If it's too much trouble for you now to write, are you saying the intelligent design argument? No, I don't think it's the intelligent design argument. If you look at what the result is, the result is much more advanced than previous. For the intelligent design people, God has to come into it, and it's going in one direction. Oh, I see what you're saying, because Rav Kook believes it's always going in one direction. It's a good point you're making. They didn't have intelligent design in those days. Evolution was much simpler. Correct. I agree. I understand what you're saying. But if you just look at it from the outside, we have humans who can now use their intellects, who can think. That has to be a progression over individual cells. I don't see how you can argue differently. What I want to say is that Rabbi Kelman mentioned the issue of, say, homosexuality, which the seminary voted on today. That's why the issue is so intractable, I think, because the people pushing the various gay rights issues and agendas... hold on for a minute. Civilization progressing is a social progression. Yes, but Rav Kook saw a parallel to progression of physicality that the human body is formed from less... you start off at individual cells, and you progress higher and higher, so a human being that can think, that can involve himself in the world, that parallels the social world, the social progression
Mark,
in his
go
mind.
Mark, I want to go back for a second. I have a question on what you said before. How does Rav Kook reconcile the Gemaras that say the previous generations are like Malachim, or we're like Chamorim? Isn't that a problem with his philosophy, that we're progressing?
I think he would say, by the way... Menachem Kellner writes about this as well in his book on the Rama. I think he would say, yes, the great sages. He's not saying that we're greater than Rabbi Akiva. He's talking about the world as a whole. He's not even talking about the Jewish world only. He's talking about the whole world as a whole. Hamon Am. What I'm saying is I have to believe that even Rav Kook would acknowledge that certain things, even the Gedolim of his day, were more sensitive to than others. Or maybe he wouldn't, but certainly we can say that. He's speaking about the world as a whole. The fact that in his day you have League of Nations, you have movements for universal suffrage. You have movements to stop persecution in Africa and elsewhere. No one thought of these things in medieval times. It wasn't on the agenda. So Mike made right. What I want, Hillel, is after this, I will call you on the phone and you will explain this to me. And then next class, I will be able to pass on, or we'll get you a microphone to explain, because I'm very interested to hear what your thoughts on this. I want to make a few more comments before we end about homosexuality then. The people pushing the gay rights issues and the reason gay rights have become accepted throughout the Western world as a human rights issue, it's not because these people are somehow evil, an act of evil rebellion against religion. No, this is Hillel Bezdin, the late Rabbi Abraham Bezdin's son, those who might have the books he wrote on the Rav. Before people thought that he was one who discovered the Rav and was writing the Rav's Torah, before it became fashionable, before everyone was doing it. The first works written by a Talmud summarizing the Rav's ideas were written by Rabbi Avraham Bezdin. As I said, the people do the homosexual agenda, is another evil rebellion against Halakha. They are being pushed by a strong moral calling, and it has become a human rights issue. Yeah, buy the book. So we see that there's a heightened sensitivity to moral issues in our day, perhaps even at the expense of Torah. Because obviously Torah can't coexist with homosexuality. But I will say that Rav Kook, ahead of his time again, discusses homosexuality. He advances the strange and, from our perspective, naive view that the permission for man to engage in anal sex with his wife helps. Why did the rabbis permit this? It's designed to help someone with homosexual tendencies satisfy his urges. I mean, he has a whole thing about that's what, why there's permission for unnatural sex, because it allows people with these urges to somehow channel their, at least if they're not completely homosexual. It's a strange idea. If you want to see more of it, I don't want to talk about it. I'm not comfortable per se. But Rabbi Betzalel and Matt Lor, both on his website, you can find the essay on Refukin Homosexuality, as well as in his book, Betzalel and Matt Lor, From a Kabbalist Diary. He has his essay on Rav Kook and homosexuality, but in so many ways, we see again that Rav Kook was ahead of his time, focusing with this issue. We have just a couple minutes. I haven't even got to, we'll do it next class, I'll say a couple more comments, what I think we really cannot take from Rav Kook today, but let me just say a few more comments, I'll get the 1 minute warning. I will say that his idea of evolution, don't think this is unusual for Rav Kook. He believed that all the world's philosophies have aspects of truth. They don't have complete truth. Even anarchy. I was reading over Shabbos' eight notebooks. Shmonek Lutzen, he speaks about the positive nature role of anarchy. He speaks about idolatry having positive aspects to it. Socialism. Every philosophy has truths. Sometimes they can have one or two truths. They don't have the complete truth. All these, you have to take the truths and join them with Torah. I think he believes that Torah has the complete truth. The problem is it's latent. Sometimes we need these other philosophies to help us draw out these truths. In fact, so far, I mean, these truths have to be redeemed. So far, Rav Kook's ideas. Ad kan. With the caveat that there's a great deal more we could say, and there's a great deal that has not yet been published. It is possible that new and exciting ideas await their appearance. As I said, over Shabbos, I was reading the Shmona Kvatzim, and I saw that something which I wish I knew about when I wrote my book on the Rambam Zikarim, the principles. He takes issue in it, and this was only published recently, with Rav Kook's concept of faith, of emunah, namely that you have to believe certain principles, believe certain ideas. Rav Kook says that while there are true ideas, and if you deny them, that's bad, it doesn't make you a heretic. Denial of true beliefs, denial of the Rambam Zikarim does not make you a heretic. Maybe if he's talking about particular ones, maybe if you deny the first, God, then you'd be a heretic, but not the rest. It doesn't separate you from your people. Even maybe not denying God, because the atheist denied God, and he thought that they were part of the Jewish people. What he says is that if you deny certain Ikarim, certain beliefs, and this denial manifests itself in actions of rebellion against Torah, or will of necessity lead to these actions, then you are outside our group. You are a heretic. You're not part of our collective. But if you just have a heretical idea, that does not make you a heretic. And he says that this is the Rambam's position, Rav Ben David, who said, why is the Rambam calling these people heretics? They don't know any better. This is what they believe. So this is a fascinating view of Rav Kook denying the Rambam's position that if you don't accept certain principles, you have left the Jewish collective, you're a heretic. I now want to focus on what I believe is no longer relevant in Rav Kook's thought, because it is central to his thought. And this is where I think some of you might really take sharp issue with some of the things I'm going to say. How many minutes do we have? Perhaps we can start it. Rabbi Kelman? Or are we done?
I'd say not too many, just to be sort of fair to everybody. I don't have a problem, but...
I think then we'll have some questions. You know what I think? I think we should stop. 10:15? You want to go 10:15? Okay, 10:15.
You know what? You know. I don't think it's fair to the people.
Okay, people.
I think people would be shy to say no. You know, we call it for an hour.
Okay.
We can have informal talk.
We'll pick up then next class. I will give you my ideas where I think Rav Kook is no longer relevant, and we've moved beyond him. Which I said, as I said, I think it'll be some of you will take sharp issue, and then we'll have time. Hopefully, I'll at least give you a brief, maybe half hour. On Rabbi Chilak of Weinberg, you know, it's as Rav Tarfon says, it's not for us to finish.
I am willing. We could talk about a sixth class that people are into. In other words, instead of going longer, if people want, they can email us and let us know, and then we can, you know, we'll have a little more time to develop Rav Kook and the Sri Deish. After all, you wrote a whole book on the Sri Deish, and you need more than half an hour.
Yeah, although I gave a talk in Toronto. In any event, if we do have questions or comments before we end, now's a good time. I will be calling Hillel Bezdin after I get off, if it's not too late, you can tell me, because I do want to hear about this, what he has to say about evolution. I have been reading about the debates between in Jewish action, about intelligent design, because I'm interested in how Orthodox Jews, if they think this is something good for the Jews, and I was surprised to see how many Orthodox Jews think intelligent design is a bad thing for Orthodox Jews. Any questions or comments, things that weren't clear on what we said today? Now we're getting the Rav did not speak. If in the last tradition, there's an article, I think it's by Jeffrey Sachs, it's on the Rav and Rav Kook. They did not have any dealings. Rav Soloveitchik met him when he went to the land of Israel in 1935. He read his Orot HaTshuva on repentance. I believe he quotes him one time in the writings we have so far. He was not sympathetic, we'll talk about next class, to his form of Zionism. Rav Tzvi Yehuda has a whole placard against Rav Soloveitchik. Maybe I'll mention this next time, Rav Soloveitchik's ideas of Zionism. He was not sympathetic. He thought he was obviously a great tzaddik, a great sage, but he was not sympathetic to his ideas. And Rav Kook himself, when he met Rav Soloveitchik, he said that he has the soul of his grandfather, Rav Chaim, who obviously Rav Kook knew from Volozhin. But they are come from a totally different perspective, and I think that Rabbi Kelman is correct, or what he mentioned, someone said, that people are now going to be turning to Rav Soloveitchik for a more real-world type of Zionism, which was overtaken after 1967. I will do that. I don't know. It's a good question you're asking. It's the Yusufro question, really. Do the gods command that it's wrong not to steal because it's wrong, or is it wrong because the gods command it? Obviously, Gizrit's not. Pretty much all Jewish thinkers believe that there's a natural law, and it's wrong. I don't think the Rav would think that you should give tzedakah or you should not do bad things because it's even the Rambam wasn't like that. The Rambam dealt with the problem. On the one hand, it says in there's a famous Gemara that says the Rambam actually the Rav and Rasada would very much disagree with you because the Rambam disagreed with you. The Rambam asked the question, on the one hand, the Talmud says that when we see a non-kosher item, we're supposed to desire it. And we're supposed, he says, Shmona Parkin, he writes about this, and we're supposed to say, I really would want to have this hot dog at the baseball game, but I can't, because Torah says not to. I know it's hard for us to say, especially if it's lobster, because we're so turned off, but that's what the Gemara says you're supposed to. But the Rambam says, well, this doesn't make any sense. Does that mean that, and what about I'm supposed to want to steal? But I don't steal because the Torah says not to. The Rambam says you have to distinguish. In the ritual areas, like kosher, something like that, for you know, you're supposed to say, yes, there's nothing wrong, it's good food, but Torah says we can't. But in moral areas, and stealing, and killing, and all these moral areas, if you say that I really want to, but I don't because the Torah says, on the contrary, you're at a very low level. You know, that's a very low level. You're supposed to be at the level of where you wouldn't ever dream of stealing. In fact, on Yom Kippur, you're supposed to sit there and wonder about, why am I saying these things? I could never dream of doing all these terrible things that we read in the liturgy. But being that we're all a unity, we say them. The Rav Soloveitchik would agree with Rav Kook, but he would disagree with this idea that we're moving forward. Rav Soloveitchik was much more hesitant and much more suspicious of human nature, of grand plans, of messianic strivings, of... we'll talk next class. I think this is one of the areas that Rav Kook, we've moved beyond. Yeah. why, again, according to Rav Henkin, is just a temple? He doesn't say that the destruction of the temple is a positive step to the messianic era in the way the Reform Jews do. What he says is that once the temple is destroyed, there is a positive element that we no longer use capital punishment. From a cook's perspective, if we were worthy and the temple remained standing, another way would have been found to abolish capital punishment. But we were supposed to see the good in everything. Rav Hirsch writes about it also. So that is one way. Tefillah, our whole davening, the whole thing we do, that's a positive that can never come about. You know, without the creation of Rabbinic Judaism, after the destruction of the temple, the getting rid of the Sadducees. Once we're exiled, the Sadducees die out. So there are positive things, even in something negative. Had we still had a temple, they would have come about in a different way. Mashiach born on Tisha B'Av, exactly. You know, you have the good comes out of the bad. Okay.
Careful, you're getting into Shabtai Tzvi territory.
No, it's not. Well, first of all, Rav Kook was a Kabbalist. That's what he writes about. All Mekubalim agree that there are sparks of holiness in the physical, even in the evil, and that you can draw these sparks of holiness. You could take a nigun. You could take a sailor song, and you could take the words and put different words, or just you can raise it in holiness. There are sparks of holiness in everything waiting to be redeemed. That's our job, and because they've been scattered. And when we do enough of that, we'll be at messianic times. And our job is to go out and raise up all these sparks, make Balei Tshuva, and take the physical Avoda B'Gashmius, Hasidim said. Rav Kook was very much influenced by Kabbalah and Hasidut. Even sex, you raise it up. Avoda B'Gashmius, when you're working in your store, it's a spiritual thing. Eating is an act of worship for the Hasidim. Louis Jacobs has an article on this. So how is eating an act of worship? Because you raise up the sparks of holiness. Rav Kook is working on that. So he, a Hasid, and a Kabbalist can see the holiness, or the potential holiness, even in the wickedness. So Shabtai Tzvi was working on real Kabbalistic ideas. He didn't make this stuff up. The question is, where do you draw the line? I don't think you can become a Muslim and try to draw out the sparks of Islam.
I heard quoted once in the name of Rav Kook that, you know, Avodah Zarah is basically is a wonderful thing, almost. It's Avodah, it's just a little bit czar. It's a little bit strange, but within Avodah Zarah, you know, is a lot of potential. It's a lot better than, you know, secularism. There's the worship for Avodah. It's Avodah, that's Zara. So even within Avodah Zara, there's a lot of potential for good.
He writes about that. There's a big argument about what's worse, Avodah Zara or atheism. Rav Kook writes, exactly what Rabbi Kelman said, that the positive thing about Avodah Zara is the fact that they have such spirituality, and they have such commitment, they're willing to sacrifice children, they're enthused about religion. The problem is how they direct it, and therefore we can direct it to the proper way. When you look back to the land of Israel, you ask yourself, how could they worship a golden calf? How could they, in the land of Israel, worship all the idols when they came in, all these things? It's because they were suffused with spirituality, which is dangerous. Because you have so much spirituality, it's very easy that it could go off. It's a lot easier to have nothing. So that's the problem. They had such spirituality that it was hard to keep it under control. And that's why, that's how you can explain the idea that the more religious, the more pious you are, the greater your sahara you have. I mean, there's, even these bad things have such potential in them. Rav Kook, not just Rav Yaakov Weinberg, talks about Berdyshevsky as almost being a holy heretic. That is, there's such, the heresy is so profound that it's almost holy, because you can learn a lot from them. They get rid of all of our many heretics, Rav Kook says. They're just getting rid of all of our bad conceptions about God. And you know, there's so much positive in there. That's why it's so dangerous where Rav Kook is treading. You can very easily fall off. And many people thought that better not to publish these writings. Okay, I don't know if anyone has any comments. If not, I'm sure, as in previous weeks, I'll get lots of emails. We'll pick up next class. What we'll do is begin right from the start. Be here on time, please, where I believe, at least, Rav Kook, certain things no longer are that relevant to us and are very problematic, and then we'll see where I go. Maybe we'll start with Jacob Weinberg, or maybe it'll
Rabbi
turn
Kelman,
into a debate.
Are we having the sixth session?
Well, why don't we decide next week?
Right. We already have 3-4 votes in favor. Let people email us, info@torahandmotion.org. You can email us if you're interested, and we're happy to make a sixth session.
Okay.
And we have to get some people who are missing this week. Let them know.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, everyone, then have a good Shabbos, and it's very cold here, although I'm sure it's colder in Toronto, and... wish everyone the best. I look forward to seeing you. I'm speaking actually on Motzei Shabbos for the Syrians on Rav Avadia Yosef, who in a certain sense is not modern Orthodox like we think of, but he is a modern Orthodox thinker in that he has brought the Sfardim up to date and has a whole new approach. So if anyone wants to hear about
politics or learning.
I say right at the beginning of my talk, politics lachud, Torah lachud, that you have to separate the two. Because in the political side, he has certain things which are totally outrageous, and that will be forgotten, thankfully. But in the learning side, it is quite incredible. And that's part of the paradox of the man, that someone who could soar the heights of Torah greatness can reflect the low culture of his youth. He can talk about giving land for peace and so humanistic. On the other hand, he can call Arabs snakes. I mean, so it's a paradox. But he, I will basically, I conclude that he is the most important rabbi since the Shulchan Aruch, certainly for the Sephardim. He has permanently changed the course of Torah history, unlike any other figure in the last couple of generations, perhaps Rav Kook, but Rav Vadya Yosef has changed the course of Torah history permanently. And if you want to hear about that, we can have a seventh class.
Even for Ashkenazim?
No, not
even
for
Ashkenazim.
Not for Ashkenazim. Not for Ashkenazim. But I tell you, the Shulchan Aruch changed the course of Torah history, but not because of the Shulchan Aruch, because of the Ramah. He has not changed the course of Torah history for Ashkenazim. He has changed it for Sephardim. But for, you don't, maybe for Ashkenazim, remains to be seen, but certainly for Sephardim. But no, the Ashkenazic world has not accepted him, and then that's something I discuss also. Why not? Why haven't they? And it has to do with methods of learning. His method of learning is not, it's not regarded as a method of learning.
Right. It's not Lamdish.
The talk is being given for the Syrians. They have a big show in there. I don't remember the name exactly. In any event, I will see you all. Good night. Take care. Bye-bye.
Good night. Thanks a lot.